Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Episode 43, and we're talking all about Jaguar. Mostly because last week, Andrew, you wrote a very funny piece on Drive Nation about blowing up a couple of very special Jaguars. So as a reminder, but also for people who might not have seen it, can you just run us through that tale again, please?
Yeah, I mean, obviously this year is the 60th anniversary of the launch of the Jaguar E-Type. And I think as far as British sports cars are concerned, I think that's probably our finest contribution to the world of cars. I mean, and I think in terms of all cars of British origin, it's up there with the Austin 7 and the Mini and the McLaren F1, I guess. And so it's a pretty important event. And I was just sitting there thinking, how do I write about this? Because everybody's going to be doing the story of the E-Type. And I just thought, well, you know, just try and do something a bit personal. And I just happen to have, yes, well, I didn't actually blow one of them up. I just thought that I had, but I did blow the other one up comprehensively. So yeah, that's what I wrote about.
So they were not just any E-types, were they? I think you explained in the story there were two original prototypes.
Yeah, they made the first. I think they were the first two E-types. They were prototypes, full of prototype bits. One was a coupe, one was a roadster, unsurprisingly, and. Yeah, and the Roadster isn't actually owned by Jaguar today, but it is on permanent loan to it. So they effectively have it. But the coupe is owned by a historian and writer, a chap called Philip Porter, who is behind the Porter Press, if you've ever seen any of those sort of large and luxurious car books that he does. And when, in the late 1990s, he got this car, and it was a complete, I mean, it was almost in, you know, cardboard boxes. It was, you know, it was an absolute start again restoration. I mean, to give you an idea, the car in its time had been right-hand drive, left-hand drive, and then right-hand drive. I mean, the car had been, you know, like many of these prototypes, it had a life and a half. Anyway, he put it all back together again. And the thing about that car was it was the car that, with the help of a very, how can I put this? Healthy engine did do 150 miles an hour for the auto car road test back in early 1961. And he wanted to make sure or find out whether it would do it again. And I'm not going to go into
a similarly because, healthy engine.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a bit of a story behind just how healthy that engine is. On the one side, you will find people who will tell you it was a completely standard engine, and all they did was they got one which they happened to know had given good figures on the dynamometer, because the way those things were built that day, there was always some difference in the tolerances, and some were just better than others, and so they issued one of the good ones. And at the other end of that spectrum, you'll find people who tell you, well, basically it's got a Le Mans winning racing D-type engine in it, which it didn't. And Philip did a huge amount of research into this, and I did come up with what sounded to me like a plausible spec for the car. So it had It was sort of the, you know, the heads and the manifolds of gas flowed. It had big valves in it. It had some clever piston rings, which allowed a lot less oil to circulate around the engine than otherwise it would. And so on. So it was warm. Well, I don't think it was even hot. So, you know, Jaguar always used to claim 265 horsepower for that engine and conveniently forgot to mention that was a gross figure. I think the normal ones probably gave, I don't know, 220, something like that. And I suspect his one probably gave 250, 260. And anyway, it was enough to coax this thing up to 150 miles an hour in 1961. And in 2000, me and... I called him an eight-year-old Chris Harris in the Post, and some people have thought that I meant literally.
Yeah, he they tried to count back, didn't they?
He wasn't 8 years old. But he was. To me, he was, because he was just the sort of the office lad. But he was the poor sod who had to sit next to me, and there was no room in the car for helmets, and it didn't have any seat belts, and we went barreling around the Millbrook Speed Bowl, faster and faster, with this thing understeering furiously. And then, because of the way the aero on those cars used to work, or more to the point, didn't work, and the back came more and more off the ground, the understeer would sort of turn to oversteer, and I was starting to get a bit twitchy about the whole thing when it blew up. And Chris, I mean, the first I knew about it, Chris started pointing to the mirror, which I looked in and saw we were towing this ball of smoke around the track with us. And then the engine note changed, and then I thought, yeah, that's not good. And so, yes, and I think it was another complete rebuild. I don't know what I'd done, but something very serious. And yet a few months later, he turned up again with a big smile on his face, with another engine in his car, all the same engine rebuilt, and we went off, and, you know, it was fine. And we did 148.2. Anyway, whatever we did, it wasn't 150, but on those speed bowls, because of the banking, cars never go as fast as they could do. But whatever we did, it was more than equivalent of 150 miles an hour on the flat. So that's that.
Well, that's very cool. It's a cool story. But I actually can't quite believe how brave you are and how idiotic Chris was to sit next to you in this ancient E-Type doing 150 miles an hour around that place. I must be soft, because I just don't fancy that from either.
To be honest with you, I didn't much fancy it. And the reason I did it was I'd gone all the way up there, and I just hadn't thought about this. It never occurred to me that there wouldn't be enough room to put a lid on. Chris had a lid on, I think. I think he did because he's a little one. And I just couldn't. If I could, believe me, I would have. But I wouldn't have been able to drive the car. Neither of us had any seat belts, because there weren't any belts in the car. And the thing is, if you go all the way up there, and the bloke's there, and it's his pride and joy, you're not going to go, oh, well, terribly sorry, I'm a bit tall, and it hasn't got any belts. Because he'd say, well, you know, it didn't have any belts when it was new. What do you expect? And I just hadn't thought about it. So because I was, you know, a lot younger and perhaps even more stupid then than I am now, I just went and did it, and it was fine.
Live to tell the tale. Okay, well, that's just our way of getting into Jaguar as a topic. But of course, the story starts well before the E-Type. So let's go back to the start, when the name Jaguar didn't even exist.
No, I mean, the start was way back, you know, in the 1920s, when Bill Lyons, William Lyons, was living in Blackpool, and he met a bloke called William Walmsley. And we're not going to dwell too much on the pre-war stuff, because I don't think it's necessarily the most interesting period. But, they started the company. I think Lyons was so young, they had to wait until he was 21 before they could even sort of officially get going with it. But it was called Swallow Sidecars. And then started off making sidecars for motorcycles. And then they started doing some very highly regarded versions of things like the Austin 7, the Austin 7 Swallow, and that sort of thing. And then, you know, in the normal progression of things, they started making cars. And they made, you know, Swallow sidecars became SS cars, and they made the SS1 and the SS2. And they actually called a thing a Jaguar for the first time in, I think, 1935. But that was like a sort of a model name. And then obviously, you know, and by then, you know, cars like the SS100, 3.5 liter SS100 is to me one of my absolute dream cars. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. If not, go and look at a photograph of one, because they are just gorgeous. I mean, to me, visually, every bit as beautiful as any pre-war Bentley or Aston Martin or anything else. And then obviously, you know, after the war, a company calling itself SS probably wasn't going to sell a large number of cars. So they had to think of something else to call the company. And so, yeah, SS cars became Jaguar, and on they went.
Okay, so Jaguar, when was this? Immediately after the war, so late 40s?
Yeah, exactly, immediately after war. I mean, the absolute, you know, their defining product, the thing that set them on the way was the XK120, which someone will start shouting at their smartphone when I say this, but I think the XK120 came out in, it was either 48 or 49. And it was the most extraordinary car, because it was utterly beautiful. I mean, you know, if you, to me, an XK120 with spats covering up the rear wheels.
Oh, so you will have spats then?
Oh yeah, I'd have, of course you'd have spats, yeah. An XK120 Roadster, black, with red upholstery and spats. I mean, oh, yeah, that can really, really get me going. Apart from the fact I don't fit in the bloody things, but anyway. It looked extraordinary, and yes, they did sort of nick the styling from the pre-war BMW 328, but we won't dwell on that. And obviously under the bonnet there was an engine. There was a completely new straight six alloy head twin cam 3.4 litre motor, which would go on to become, you know, one of the most highly regarded. I mean, if you think what that engine did, you know, as well as power, you know, any number of Jaguar saloons and sports cars, it also powered enormous limousines, and it won Le Mans 5 times.
Mm, that's pretty cool, isn't it?
This was a road car engine. And also, you know, and you think of all the other, you know, all the sort of English garagista manufacturers, guys like Lister and Cooper and HWM and all that sort of thing, who just, because this engine was so strong, it gave such good power, it was so easy to look after, they just went and made their cars, and they just thought, well, we're going to power it by, of course, you just go and stick an XK engine in it. So that got them going. And once they had the XK120, suddenly, you know, all the other manufacturers that were around at the time were thinking, you know, if you think that this was at the same time that Aston Martin was coming up with the DB2, and the DB2 had a smaller, less powerful engine. It was massively more expensive than the XK120. I think most people would probably agree with me that although I do actually genuinely love the look of a DB2, it's a slightly unusually looking car, whereas I think there can't be a petrol head in the world who doesn't think an XK120 is a stunning piece of design.
Mm. And it's a very pretty thing. I'm just looking at a couple of pictures now. You're right. There's the second image on Google is a black car with the wheel spats. It's a coupe. And it looks like it's sitting suspiciously close to the ground. It is. But it looks actually sinister, but also beautiful. Yeah, great, great bit of design. So at this point, the XK120 has come along and changed the game. Was it the 120 that broke speed records for production cars?
Yeah, it did. Norman Jewis, the great Norman Jewis, my mate Norman. Jaguar by that stage, they were very, very keen on getting publicity, and they knew they were onto a good thing for the car. So they sent him off in, you know, production. It was pretty highly modified with a very aerodynamic body. But I mean, he went off to this big long straight in Belgium and did 170 something miles an hour in one, which got an awful. Can you imagine what that would have been like? I presume the thing was swerving around all over the place. I don't know, but yes, brave boy.
Just before we skip along, that engine, is it really true that this engine was in production until the 90s?
Yes, it was. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? You know, it was designed immediately after the war, and it was, you know, it was absolutely the mainstream of, you know, what you would find in your Jaguar all the way for, I mean, it powered apart, I mean, until the V12 came in 1971. So all through the 50s, all through the 60s, it was the only engine you could have. And they did it in various different capacities. There was a 2.4, 2.8, 3.4, 3.8, and a 4.2. But then they had the V12, but the 6 obviously kept going all the way through the 80s. And I think the last thing it was in, I think, was some kind of Daimler limo, which did indeed survive until the 1990s, 92, I think. Absolutely incredible.
So the oldest versions of that engine are older than you, and the youngest versions are younger than me.
My goodness, that puts it into perspective. Thank you for that, Dan.
Pleasure, that's what I'm here for. okay. And but maybe the most significant thing about the Jaguar twin cam straight six is what it managed after the XK 120, immediately after.
Oh, well, the racing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it wasn't really designed as a racing engine. I mean, you know, we think about the V12, which came into production in 1971. They started talking about a V12 engine for racing in 1951. Okay, they weren't that keen on the six-cylinder engine for racing purposes because, I mean, it really was built as a road car engine. And one of the reasons you could tell that was it had a very long stroke and a very narrow bore because back then cars were taxed on the width of their bores. And so, you know, all early engines like that are that's why they all have so much torque, because they have these massive long strokes and these tiny little bores, which is great for road car use because, as I say, you get lots of low down torque and that's great. But it's hopeless for racing because you just can't get that kind of power in it. And at the same time, they were up against the, you know, V12 Ferraris in, you know, right throughout their 50s racing campaigns. You know, the V12 Ferrari was like kind of the staple opposition. And, you know, they wanted an engine that could compete. And, you know, they had a 3.4 litre straight six up against 4.1, 4.5 litre V12 Ferraris. And so they started very seriously thinking, in fact, what they did, their idea was that they would effectively create, they'd get two XK engines and stick them on a common crank, but with a very short stroke. So instead of being what they call an undersquare engine, where your stroke is longer than your bore, it would become an oversquare engine. And it was all scoped out. It was going to be a 5-litre V12, not the 5-litre V12 that went into the XJ13 in the mid-1960s, because the early 1950s V12 never came to anything. But, you know, that was the plan. And it was only when, despite it all, Jaguars started winning Le Mans, that they thought, oh, well, maybe we don't need to do this. And they didn't, because, you know, the XK engine was good enough, and particularly once Malcolm Sayer, the genius aerodynamicist, was designing their racing cars for them. And what they discovered was whatever they lost in, you know, in brute force to the Ferraris down the straight, they would more than make up in aerodynamic efficiency. So they'd all come honking out of Tête Rouge at Le Mans, and the Ferraris would duly drag away into the distance, and then they'd just sit there on the straight, and the Ferraris would hit a brick wall at 140, 150 miles an hour, and the Jaguars would just keep going. And by the end of the straight, the Jaguars would be in front, and that was enough.
What was it? Enzo allegedly said, "Aerodynamics are for people who can't build engines."
I'm not sure he was right about that. I think Jaguar proved he was probably wrong about that. But at the same time, what I would say is that Ferraris of that era were designed to win everywhere. They were designed to win at Le Mans or, you know, or Sebring or the Targa Florio or the Mille Miglia. Jaguars were only ever designed to win on the quickest circuits because that was the only place their aero could really make the difference. You know, if you look at all the races that Jaguar won in the 1950s, I don't think they ever entered the Targa Florio. There was a sort of slightly works entry into the Mille Miglia in 1952, but that was to do with disc brakes. That wasn't because they thought they could win it. They just didn't go into races like that because they knew they didn't have a chance. They needed places with long, long straights. And so they did okay at places like Reims. They won the 12 hours there once, and obviously Le Mans, which was back then, you know, without any chicanes, without Porsche curves, was, you know, you would have been flat to the floor for, I don't know, 80-90% of the lap. And there they could really make the difference. And, you know, they designed their cars to win Le Mans, not to win the World Sports Car Championship at all, which they never did. The XK120 became the XK120C, C for competition. But in fact, if you look at a C-type and an XK120, there's really very little they have in common, other than obviously, you know, they're running it, the engine and the gearbox is the same. But they, you know, the chassis isn't remotely similar. An XK120 is a pretty conventional ladder chassis, and a C-type's a tubular space frame. I think some elements of the front suspension were common to both, but it was a racing car. And it went off in it, and it got the job done, you know, and with the D-type that followed it five times in seven attempts, although the last two in 56 and 57 weren't works entries. They were the Acura cost cars. Jaguar as a works team won Le Mans in 51 and 53 with the C-Type. They did win it in 55, obviously the tragic race where all those people died. But I think most objective observers will tell you they only won that race because the Mercedes team pulled out. At the time, they pulled out at like 2 o'clock in the morning. Fangio and Moss were leading the race in the Mercedes by, you know, a big amount. The Jaguars had effectively been vanquished, but Mercedes pulled out, and so they won the race, and a win's a win's a win. And then Acura Cost as a private team using, you know, basically showroom standard cars, won in 56 and 57, and, you know, and the rest is history.
Yeah, I mean, nevertheless, winning Le Mans five times in 7 years is an enormous achievement. And it's that sort of thing that, I mean, it feels like a big deal at the time, I would think, but now, looking back at it, it kind of underpins Jaguar's entire heritage, particularly motorsporting heritage, doesn't it? It's the backbone of it all, really.
There is no doubt to me that in some subliminal way, Jaguar is still selling cars today on the back of those Le Mans victories in the 1950s, and obviously those in the late 80s and early 90s too, because they created the character of the brand, didn't they? If we think of Jaguar, you know, despite the fact that they make, you know, SUVs and, you know, four-door saloons and estate cars and all this rather sort of, you know, middle-of-the-road stuff, Jaguar is a sports car brand, isn't it? And why is Jaguar a sports car brand? Jaguar is a sports car brand because it won Le Mans five times in seven attempts in the 1950s. And that's where it all comes from. And so that's the value of doing that sort of thing. And that's why I just don't understand those manufacturers who toddle off to, like BMW is the great example of this, who toddled off to Le Mans, won it once in 1999 and thought, well, I've done that now, never need to go back. Bang. You know, you got to make it stick. And, you know, all those other great teams, you know, Bentley and Ferrari and Ford and Audi and, you know, and obviously Porsche, have got that point and have done great things for their brands because of it.
It's really interesting, isn't it? I think when manufacturers are engaging in motorsport, they have to think of it as not just a sort of short to medium term investment, but you're basically doing your successors 30, 40, 50 years down the line an enormous favor. I think about Toyota when it finally won Le Mans for the first time.
Yeah,
it hardly mattered that actually they only beat privateer teams because the
manufacturers
had disappeared. Nobody remembers that. And when in, I don't know, 20, 30 years time, Toyota wants to call on some genuine motorsport heritage to sell its latest cars, it can say, we won Le Mans in 2017, whatever it was.
Yeah, absolutely.
It really matters.
And it doesn't even matter if it's one of your customer teams that does it, as it did for Jaguar for their last two wins. Doesn't matter at all. A Jaguar won Le Mans. That's all anybody ever remembers. You know, nobody remembers the circumstances. Nobody remembers who came second. And nobody remembers who was, you know, running the team that entered the car that won the race. It was a Jaguar. It won the race. And that is all anybody remembers.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. Okay, so from being from world-beating success on the racetrack at Le Mans, world-beating road cars followed. First of them is... Now, if anyone has watched The Crown, that Netflix drama, it's really good, actually, but there is a scene where... and I'm pretty sure it's Queen Elizabeth goes up to Jaguar in Coventry to have a look around, and she's shown around a particular model that's presented as the MK1.
Oh dear.
Yeah, it grates. But anyway,
is that what they called it?
That's what they say in the show, in The Crown, dear. Yeah, the MK1.
And they're usually so good at that sort of thing that series. God, I hadn't spotted that.
I can't believe there wasn't one person on the set that just went, excuse me, it's a Mark 1. But anyway, we're not talking about the Mark 1, we're talking about the Mark 2.
Yes, but largely because the Mark 1 was only become retrospectively known as the Mark 1 after the Mark 2 had come out.
Of course.
It's like Jaws wasn't called Jaws 1, was it? And the Mark One, which was, yeah, it looks like a Mark Two, but was a rather flawed car. So it was the car that tragically Mike Hawthorne died in early 1959. But later that year, as you say, yeah, the Mark Two came out. Which was a sort of mid-sized saloon, but it was, if you look back to the XK120 and why that was so good, well, it was so good because it looked amazing. It was really affordable and it drove fantastically. And they just reinvented that. They just thought, well, let's do it again, but in a saloon car format. And that was the Mark II. And they're just wonderful cars. You think of Mark II now is, the most desirable is the manual 3.8 litre. So it's the manual gearbox with the biggest engine they could shovel under the bonnet. Most of them have been breathed on, warmed up, because they're just so easy to tune. But if you just go and drive, which I did quite recently, a nice standard car, and you think this thing is over 60 years old, it'll just blow your mind away because it's so good. It was such a, on one hand it was quiet and it was comfortable and it did all the, big saloon things that you needed to do. And on the other hand, they were complete weapons. That's why they were beloved by sort of getaway drivers and bank robbers and all that sort of thing, because they were so rapid and you could still get lots of loot and, conspirators in there with you. And brilliant machines. And I don't know if I'm sure many people listening to this have seen them racing at Goodwood, and guys like Grant Williams, sending them as sideways as you can possibly be imagine anything going sideways. If you're my sort of age and you sort of grew up watching, the Sweeney and things like that, they were just part of your upbringing because that's what all the bad guys drove. And it was just, I'm very, very fond of those things.
I think I remember reading or hearing somewhere that the police had to get Mark IIs because they were the only things that would keep up with Mark IIs.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. And you didn't want to get the Mark II with a 2.4-litre engine in it. That wasn't going to be good. So, you could get a 2.4, a 3.4, or a 3.8. 3.4s, actually, I think they made more 3.4s than anything else. And a 3.4 is actually more than good enough. There's not a huge amount of difference. But obviously, if you can get a 3.8 and you can get manual gears, that's what you want to go for. But you pay proper money for those now.
Oh, do you? Okay, so a couple of years after the Mark II, in 1961, as we've said, the E-Type arrived. We've spoken a bit about the E-Type already, but let's just briefly touch on it again, because what did it change about the sports car world? What did it do that was new, apart from look very beautiful?
Well, a bit, actually, quite a bit. Obviously, it pulled the same trick that they'd pulled with the 120 and with the Mark II, insofar as it was more beautiful than anything else that was out there, and it was half the price of anything else that was out there. And it drove beautifully. But, this is absolutely learning from the track. It also had a monocoque construction. When Aston Martin and Ferrari, who were the rivals in all regards other than price, were still using ladders or space frames or some hybrid between the two. Because Jaguar had done so well with the D-Type at Le Mans, and the D-Type had this, well, they call it a semi-monocoque, but let's just call it a monocoque construction, they carried it over. It also had fully independent rear suspension, which no Aston Martin or Ferrari of the time did. So here was a car which was at least as beautiful, probably more beautiful than anything else that was out there. It had all this amazing technology on it, and it was half the price. Go figure. They must have just thought, what have they done? How could they have done this? And they just sold, they just couldn't make enough of them. And it was an absolute landmark car, the E-Type, because it democratized the sports car. If before the E-Type you wanted to drive a car that looked that glamorous and go that fast, you basically had to go and buy yourself a DB4 Aston at a pinch, although it wasn't as quick, or a 250 GT Ferrari, which would have, broken the bank. And yet here was the E-Type. And it wasn't a cheap car, but it was certainly wildly more affordable than its rivals. It looked probably better than any of them, and it was far more technologically sophisticated than them. I mean, absolute landmark, groundbreaking car.
Wow. That's cool. Okay, and then the third car in the world-beating triumvirate of this era was the XJ6, 1968. I've got some pictures of it, of the XJ6 here now, and it's a cool-looking thing, isn't it? But also, I mean, it must have been one of the first sort of big four-door saloon cars that was low to the ground, rather a car that you drop down into rather than step up into, because the big sort of luxury cars of the 50s were very high, tall machines, weren't they? The XJ6, they were. You look at it, is very yeah. low and very sleek, yeah. like a modern car.
Yeah, and you know, and they kept that look all the way through. I mean, all the way through. You know, pretty much into the 20th century. It's one of the things that, you know, when we were road testing, you know, its successor, you know, the XJ40. They, you know, one of the things, and also, you know, the XJ6 and the XJ10. We used to complain about one of the things that we didn't like about it was that there wasn't much room inside, and particularly things like rear headroom wasn't as good. But you know, but the choice was, you know, either have lots of space and have this rather sit up and beg traditional looking saloon, or have something that looks absolutely bloody amazing, and just accept that, you know, you won't be able to wear your top hat in the back. And you know, Jaguar went a particular way with it, and at the same time, they also, you know, the thing I remember most about those cars was just the way that they rode. You know, Rolls-Royce at the time had a Silver Shadow. You know, if you got an original XJ6 and a Silver Shadow of the same era, the Silver Shadow would feel like a wheelbarrow in terms of ride quality compared to the XJ6. They were so... I actually... Jaguar has William Lyons' company car, which is an original Mark 1 XJ6. And just occasionally they let idiots like me go and have a quick run up the road in it. And you get in it now and you will think... There are stuff in this car, in this whatever it is, this 50-something-year-old car, that designers of brand new modern cars could learn a lot from today. Just in terms, you know, if you think a modern car on its air springs rides well, or has a good secondary ride, by that I mean its ability to absorb lumps and bumps, well, yeah, they do. But then go and drive a 1968 XJ6. And be prepared to be completely gobsmacked. Now, of course, there's a trade-off because it wouldn't have the body control in high-speed corners and that sort of thing that modern cars have or anything. But if you just want to waft around, which is what lots of people wanted to do in those sorts of cars, you know, I think there's a strong argument to say that there's never been a car that has ridden significantly better than that in those regards. Absolutely amazing.
Okay, so... After dominating Le Mans for a while with the C-Type and the D-Type, and after these three astonishing cars, it was clearly after that world domination and crushing the opposition to dust.
But it didn't happen, did it?
Why not? What on earth went wrong? Bizarre, isn't it?
Well, what went wrong? I mean, the British motor industry went wrong. I mean, Jaguar got sold to the British Motor Corporation before the XJ6 came out, but long after the XJ6 would have been... agreed upon, so they knew what it was going to be. And then, you know, all the things that went wrong with the British motor industry, and maybe one day we'll do a podcast on that when we're feeling particularly down on the dumps. But it was the build quality wasn't right. The vision left the company. They just, you know, they had a formula. And they'd done it with the XK and the Mark II and the E and the XJ, and it worked. And I've explained what that formula is during the course of this podcast. And yet they decided, you know, short-termism set out. You know, if you just look at what happened to the E-Type, this unbelievably pure, gorgeous thing turned into... Okay, I mean, I'm not going to give... Lots of people will give the V12 E-Type in the mid-70s a real kicking because it wasn't what the original was. And it wasn't. I'm not one of those people. I can see that it's a car of, you know, of some merit, but it was a poor shadow of its former self. It was overweight. It was visually compromised. It was soft. And they just hadn't carried the vision through. And then you look at the XJS, again, a car that, you know, God, I'm old enough to have tested the back end of the XJS when they were new cars. You know, and I think the XJS is a car of considerable charm, But goodness me, it wasn't an E-Type, was it? You know, 1975 when that came out, you know, this is, you know, our replacement for the E-Type. Well, really? Okay. Well, you know, it's got a nice engine in it. It looks a bit old. It's quite comfortable and it's got a certain sort of loose char. But it's not absolutely well-beating. You're not going to get the people in Newport Pagnell or Maranello just quaking in their boots thinking, how on earth do we respond to this? And yeah, it was just... It just didn't work out. There were the processes and there were all the things that went wrong with the British motor industry in general and, you know, the British Motor Corporation in particular at that time. But if I could put it into one thing, I would say just for whatever reason, the vision was lost. And they were near enough sunk because of it.
Okay, that's interesting. Do you reckon it was close to going bust and... Might it have disappeared, or was there always too much goodwill? And
no, I think it would have done. I mean, you know, I came into the business in 1988, and in 1989, Jaguar got sold to Ford. By this stage, they produced, to an immense fanfare, the XJ40, which was the successor to the XJ6. And the XJ40 came out in whenever it was, late 80s. With, you know, a whole new series of engines, the AJ6 engines. And we had a long-termer at Autocar, and our editor at the time, Bob Murray, he wrote his final long-term report as an open letter to Jaguar explaining why this simply wasn't good enough. I mean, the car, it had some, you know, some great, you know, it did do some really good Jaguar stuff well. I mean, it handled well and it rode well. So the sort of, you know, the hallmark things that you'd want a Jaguar to do, it did sort of do. But it was so unreliable. You just couldn't recommend anybody actually puts their hand in their pocket and spent their own money on one of these things. And, you know, it was actually a pretty terrible time. You know, things had actually started to get better in some regards. John Egan was running the company and he was a very savvy bloke. And, you know, obviously, you know, competition success had started to come again. You know, Jaguar had won the European Touring Car Championship with a very successful Tom Walkinshaw campaign over 3 years with the XJS. And then Tom had used that as a sort of springboard to get Jaguar back to Le Mans with the... XJR, whatever it was, the 6, the 8, the 9, and the 12. And that was great. But no, what saved Jaguar, or what certainly kept Jaguar going, was it being sold to Ford in 1989. So, and you know, and that started a whole other chapter, which again, and maybe we'll go into this in a minute, you know, was quite promising, but never quite turned out to be what we'd all hoped it would be.
Let's talk about one of the most famous, most recognisable Jaguars there's ever been. But I can see in your notes that you've put the word debacle after XJ220.
Oh, yes, yes, that one. I was trying to try and work out which one you're talking about, the 220, yes.
I saw a photograph, I tweeted it actually, a photograph of an XJ220. It's just it's a car cornering, but it's a nose-on shot, really low down. And it actually doesn't look like a car at all. It's so wide and so low. It just looks astonishing. I think even now they look spectacular. So long, but I mean, you're right. The whole thing was debacle is the right word.
I mean, it wasn't all Jaguar's fault by any means. The car was actually designed by a bloke called Keith Helfert, and I think it's an amazing piece of work. I really, really do. But I'm sure lots of people know the story. The car made its debut as a kind of concept, but they'd said that they were going to make it. It would have been the Birmingham Motor Show in 1988. And, you know, I can remember seeing this thing there. Or maybe it was Earl's Court. I think it was Birmingham. And it was one of the biggest cars I'd ever seen of any kind. And yet it was a mid-engined, you know, two-seat supercar. But it had the V12 engine in it, but with a 48 valve cylinder heads. It had four-wheel drive and it was absolutely enormous, but it looked incredible. And you know what, the key thing to remember is that this was right at the back end of the sort of the Thatcher bull market, and you know, even total idiots well, like me, for instance, had been able to make money in the city at that sort of time, and the orders came flooding in, and you know, everything was all rosy. Then spool forward whatever it is, 3 or 4 years for the concept to actually make it into reality. And the world's a very, very different place. And the 220 is a very, very different car. I mean, the V12 is nowhere to be seen. In its place has come this 3.5 litre V6 of unknown origin, but which people continue to start talking about, actually, is this the same engine that was found in the back of the 6R4 Metro rally car? And it was a very close relation to that. I don't think what anybody actually knew, and it's probably as well that they didn't, was that the engine's also a very close relative of the pushrod V8 Buick engine that Rover bought. You know, it was a pushrod V8 Buick engine, but with twin cam heads put on it, and a couple of cylinders lopped off it. You know, that's where it can, and obviously a couple of turbochargers attached to it. But the thing is that by then, you know, all the people who'd got so excited about the car in 1988, none of them had any money anymore. They'd lost the lot because the world by this stage was in a global recession. And the last thing they wanted was some, you know, ruinously expensive car. I think it cost £403,000 turning up on their, you know, back then, turning up on their drive. And of course, because the car had changed so much, that was the excuse they needed. They just turned around and said, well, that's not the car I ordered. You know, I ordered a car with four-wheel drive and a massive V12 engine. And what's this thing? It hasn't got any front drive shafts. And half the engine appears to have gone missing.
And you wouldn't be happy, would you?
Cranky. Well, you wouldn't. But, you know, but at the same time, you know, there's no concept car that's ever made it into production in the same state. It's not the way the world works. You know, I have some sympathy with Jaguar in that way. What I have no sympathy for them at all is their decision to then try and sue the owners. Try and find, you know, and in PR terms, I mean, you know, that is chapter one, page one, line one. Don't do it. Don't sue your owners over things like that. Because, I mean, and that's really what did for the car. And there was no coming back. And it really was an amazing car. You know, don't forget, this is, you know, before the McLaren F1. It was kind of like the stepping stone. It was the stepping stone between, you know, the very traditional supercars that had been around up to that time, the sort of the, you know, the Countaches and the Testarossas and that sort of thing, between that and the utter insanity that was the McLaren F1. And, you know, don't forget, this is a car which, albeit with its cats taken off, did do, I think, 217 miles an hour with Martin Brundle driving it around a back circuit, which meant it would have done 220. And that was just like, you know, back in the day when this was, you know, a short number of years after the F40 had become the first car ever to do more than 200 miles an hour. And here was one which did 220. I mean, that's a big step. And I can remember doing the original road test. I can remember someone crashing the car. It wasn't me, which is perhaps another tale for another time. And yeah, it was great. But the car was a disaster. It took them, I mean, not years, decades to sell the cars. They were, you know, the last few were hanging around for such a long period of time. And of course, now the prices are starting to tick up because people are realizing that, you know, if you think of the boxes that you need to tick to make a car a good investment, well, you want it to be beautiful, check. You'd want it to be rare, very check. You want it to be amazingly fast, absolutely. You'd want it to be technologically sophisticated, and the way it's put together, it was. You'd want it to have competition success. You know, it won its class at Le Mans with David Coulthard driving it until they disqualified it for some technical irregularity. You know, it ticks all the boxes. And I think people are starting to wake up to that now and actually thinking these are pretty special cars. But at the time, they couldn't sell them. And then they dived into the shadow of the McLaren F1. And it took a very, very long time for them to emerge. I drove one quite recently and, you know, it's a slightly sort of clunky, charming old thing, but still really fast, still, you know, off the scale sense of occasion. And yeah, I'd love to have a go in another one day.
I used to have one.
Of course you did. How big was it?
8 inches, maybe. It was electric. One of the less common electric XJ220s.
Yes.
And it had a magnet underneath it to stick it to the scale electric track.
And was it one of your favourites?
Oh, no, it was. It was the favourite. Until
that was the one?
Yeah, until I got an Audi A4 touring car. And that replaced it.
Was that like a sort of a Frank Beeler spec?
Yeah.
Sort of early A4 Richard Lloyd BTCC car.
Yeah, with the four ring emblems large down the side of the car.
Yeah. Very cool.
Do you remember with Sky Electric's cars, you'd get them out of the box and you'd be delighted with it, and then you'd crash it, and the first thing that would happen is that the door mirrors would snap off.
And they'd never go back on again.
Yeah, exactly. They were just gone. Well, they made the car faster, didn't it? Not having that bit of drag. Anyway, so, right, we're 45 minutes in or so.
Oh, bloody hell.
So we probably need to get a bit of a move on, don't we? So we're into the Ford era of the 90s, which showed some promise. The XK8,
good
proper
car.
Sports car, yeah, universal acclaim.
XK8, I know we need to keep moving, but XK8 was, its genesis is just quite interesting because it's the car Jaguar refused to build. And by that, let me explain. Tom Walkinshaw, when Jaguar were looking to replace the XJS, Tom Walkinshaw went, because he'd raced the XJS and he knew the thing inside, I went to Jaguar and said, look, we could do this. We can just reskin this car and it'll be absolutely amazing and it'll cost buttons because it'll still be the same car underneath. And Jaguar went, no, we need an all-new sports car. We're going to build this thing called the XJ41. And Walkinshaw went, fair enough, toddled off to Aston Martin and said, we'll do your DB7. And that's where the DB7 came from. And then Jaguar went and pursued the XJ41, which got bigger and fatter and heavier, and you know, and suddenly got to the point where it was never going to make it. And Ford canned it and said, well, why don't you just reskin the XJS? And that was the XK8 with a fantastic V8 engine in it, which is still around to this day.
Yes, well, it's baffling, isn't it, that they were able to make a cracking car out of quite an old platform. So that car worked for them, but
yeah,
as you've noted, there seemed to be an element of complacency or laziness at this point.
Well, yeah, I mean, it got an attack of the Fords, didn't it? And you know, Ford was, they wanted a return on their investment, and they thought, you know, they stuck it in this thing called the Premier Automotive Group, didn't they? With the other stuff that they bought, so there was Aston Martin was in there, and Volvo was in there, and so on and so forth, and they just thought that, you know, their platforms were good enough for anyone, and you could create a thing called an S-Type and stick it on a, you know, a Lincoln platform, and you could make a thing called the X-Type and stick it on a Mondeo platform because they looked different and were called Jaguars. Everybody think, well, that's fine. And it just wasn't. It just wasn't even close. I mean, the S-Type and the X-Type, both in styling terms, which is so important to Jaguar. You know, the S-Type did, you know, retro in all the wrong ways, and the X-Type just looked odd. And so there was nothing, you know, and don't forget what they were up against, you know, E-classes, 5-series, 3-classes, C-3-series, C-classes, you know, just so much stuff, which was, and you know, if you're going to go up against a 3-series BMW, you've got to give people a reason to not buy a 3-series BMW. And they didn't. You can't just say, well, it's a Jaguar. Okay, it's not as good to drive, it's uglier. Its underpinnings are, you know, are very, by those standards, run of the mill. And it didn't work, and it all went terribly wrong. And then Ford started losing huge amounts of money, and needed to offload it.
Yeah, and it's a good job they did, really, isn't it? Because it was Tata who took control in 2008, and that just allowed Jaguar to be Jaguar again, or specifically Jaguars to be Jaguars again.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the Indians were so good, and to an extent still are, but, you know, certainly in those early days, I just loved the approach, which was, you know, you guys know the brand, you understand what a Jaguar should be, and we'll just, you know, we'll back you, you know, financially and in all other ways, and don't disappoint us. And they were just able to get on with it. And then cars like, you know, it's only just gone out of production. But the, you know, the new XJ came out in 2011. What an amazingly cool piece of kit that was. Fabulous interior design. And then, you know, and they did the F type, which, you know, in 2013 when they came out, we all thought was, you know, pretty amazing. And, you know, and we've gone on from there. There have been some, I wouldn't even call them hiccups. There have been some cars which, haven't been that great. I mean, I think people look back at things like the XE and the XF, which are obviously both still with us, and I think they are fine, perfectly serviceable examples of what they are. And nothing like, you know, frankly, the sheds that things like the X-Type were. But even so, I don't think that either of those provided a sufficient reason for people to get out of their Audis and their BMWs and their Mercs. But something like an F-Pace does, you know, an F-Pace, when that came out, you know, I'm not a huge fan of those sorts of SUVs, but within its class, when the F-Pace came out, it was the best car that there was. And I think it's actually aged very well. I think it's, you know, because it's quite light, because it's got an aluminium architecture on it, and because it looks good, thanks to, you know, Ian Callum, it's a really credible piece of work. So, you know, Jaguar is still doing some good stuff today.
Yeah, the F-Type, let's talk about that a little bit, because I remember doing the original launch. I think it's in the north of Spain, 2013, and it was a good car. And I think the thing about the F-Type is that it's very good despite the limitations that Jaguar was up against. For instance, the V6, which you can't get anymore, was literally the V8 with two cylinders blanked off. They're still there. The cylinders are still underneath the bonnet. They're just blanked off. And that gives you a V6.
I didn't know that.
I'd heard it a few times and it's been confirmed to me by at least one insider.
I didn't know that.
To the point where I think they'd commissioned, you know, those wonderful technical drawings. And the artist wanted to know what to do with the V6 model because he'd clearly have to have the two blank cylinders there. So I think they only did that car from, head on rather than in profile so that you wouldn't be able to tell. And the other thing about the F-Type is that it uses a sort of chopped down version of the XK platform, doesn't it, that came before it. So it's aluminium, but it's still a heavy car. It's old, relatively old technology. And I remember weighing the four-wheel drive V8 models at 1,800 kilograms, more or less. That's, 200, 250 more, perhaps, than a 911 Turbo, which is a more usable car and faster.
Yeah, I mean, were those early cars? So the early cars, they would have been convertibles, presumably.
No, these weren't very, very early cars. These were coupes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it was quite a heavy car, but it was good. It was a good, you know, I still enjoy driving. I mean, I actually, the one I enjoy most at the moment is the 2-litre car, the 300 horsepower 2-litre car. I think that's, you know, for the money, I think that is a, you know, a credible opponent for an entry level, you know, car in that class, be it a, you know, a Supra or a Cayman or whatever, or a TT, in a way that, frankly, the, whatever they're calling it, the 575 horsepower F-Type R is not a credible opponent to a, you know, a 911 these days.
The V8 ones, they cost big money. You can spend six figures on an F-Type, and at that money, it's out of its sort of comfort zone, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Right, well, we need to sort of begin to wrap this up, but also look forward. And I think we should just sort of quickly set out a blueprint for what a successful Jaguar looks like, what its heartland models are, what motorsport it's involved in, maybe talk electric a little bit, because, of course, Jaguar beat some of the big German manufacturers to market with an electric car, the I-Pace.
I think the way to look forward is to learn that lesson and also to look back. And I think the I-Pace is the great example of that. I mean, if you look back through history at all the Jaguars that have ever really, really worked, all the cars we've talked about, from, you know, the 120 to the Mark II to the E-Type, the XJ, and so on and so forth, you know, the one thing they have done is they have led. They have broken the mold. They have done things that other cars had not done up to that point, either in individual areas or more usually as a complete car. It just made a completely compelling proposition. And when Jaguar falls flat on its face is when it follows, when it does, you know, an X-Type or something like that, and just doesn't do it as well as what's already out there and established. And, you know, I think the prime example of this, and to me this is as good an example as any of those early wonderful cars, is the I-Pace. You know, that was, you know, Jaguar was first to market with a proper sort of full-sized, you know, electric SUV, and it was, you know, in the luxury car category at least, and it was just fantastic. I mean, among electric cars, it looked fantastic. It performed really, really well. It was and remains a highly desirable example of that kind of car. And of course, it's been, you know, in sales terms, it's been very, very good for them. And I'm not surprised, because it's Jaguar getting back to what Jaguar does best. And yeah, that's how it has to see the future. It's just got to be ahead of the game and not behind the curve, as it's been, you know, too often over the last whatever it's been, you know, 30, 40 years.
There has to be really, really first-rate luxury cars in there, and there's going to be an electric-only XJ at some point. It should be coming quite soon.
Well, I mean, I hear this year. That really excites me.
Yeah.
You know, because I don't think that really, really cool design costs an awful lot of money, more money than really, really crap design. And if you look at the XJ, the last XJ, the one that came out 10 years ago, and you look at the interior of that, just how, what an incredibly special place that was to sit and to be. I think that if Jaguar can do an electric XJ that in 2021 is as cool as that was in 2011, that looks that amazing, and obviously ticks all the boxes it needs to in terms of, you know, range and performance and everything else, that could be a really, really compelling car, and a very Jaguar car. So, you know, I'm just keeping everything crossed for that, because I have high hopes.
Indeed. Yeah, and in this blueprint of ours, there also needs to be a top drawer sports car, doesn't there? And inevitably, to reach the volumes that a company like Jaguar needs to, it does need to sell SUVs, sadly. It'd be good if they were more F-pace than E-pace, though, wouldn't it?
Oh, the E-pace. What were they thinking?
Yeah. Go on, just give us 20 seconds on that. I've never driven
one. Do you know what? I'm not going to. Most disappointing Jaguar I've ever driven. And I'll probably okay. include the X-Type in that.
Okay.
You know, no, compared... No, let's not go there.
Fine. Well, last question then, and to wrap this up, and we've got literally a minute. Does Jaguar need to be involved in motorsport, and does it need to be involved in a more engaging form of motorsport than Formula E?
To me, yes, absolutely. To me, and I know that Jaguar's been in Formula E for a while, and I know James Barclay, who runs their team, and you know, I think they're doing an increasingly good job. But to me, when I think of racing Jaguars, that's not what I think of. And maybe that's because I'm a 55-year-old bloke who's stuck in the past. But I'd be interested to know what youngsters think of it. You know, to me, Jaguar needs to be... I think Jaguar does need to be racing again. I think, actually, if they just had a presence, I think that would be fine. If they just did customer cars, that would be fine. And I hope that they are looking at things like LMDH or an LMH, these new... series that they can race in either the World Sports Car Championship or the WEC as it is now, or over in America, or both. Because to me, that's where Jaguar's heartland is. I think that there's plenty of opportunities in the future for them to be doing that in a way that is entirely, forgive the word, synergistic with their future aspirations and direction that they want to go in. They'd be up there competing against, you know, all their big competitors. Obviously, you know, Jaguar is a very small brand. It's part of quite a large company, but it's a very small brand, and there's not going to be a huge amount of money to go around. But you know, I would love to see Jaguar go into one of those, you know, something like LMDH, where it's almost all off the peg stuff, and you can do customer program, and yeah, it would just be great. And I don't think they would need to win. I don't think people would think, well, if Jaguar went back to Le Mans, they'd have to win first out, because, you know, I think people have their expectations. I think people would just love to see them out there, and as long as they were in the mix and, you know, cutting it with, you know, with Porsche and with Audi and everybody else who's doing it, then, you know, I think that would be fine. But yeah, to me, I'd far rather they were doing that than Formula E.
If you're wondering why we haven't spoken about Formula One, it's because, well, we covered it in detail, didn't we, in our recent podcast, Formula One's Family Tree. We talk about the unfortunate Jaguar foray into F1. So, yeah, go back to listen to that if you haven't already. But there we go. Let's leave our Jaguar podcast there. And you know the score, everyone. Please rate and review the podcast. Please check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/DriveNation. And you can bung us a few quid a month. And we will be back to talk to you again next week.
Yeah, look forward to it. All the best.
The Drive Nation podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.